Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, podcasting since 2005. You're listening to Gamertag Radio with your host, podcaster Hall of Famer Danny Pena, the always opinionated Paris Lilly, and from outside of the norm, Peter Toledo. This is Gamertag Radio.
All right, you're listening to Gamertag Radio episode 1163. This is your host, Danny. And guess what? We have a big, big episode that is only exclusive on Gamertag Radio. We have the former chief Xbox officer, Robbie Bach. He's going to be talking about his new book. It's coming out October 12th. And also, we had a long, long conversation about the 20th anniversary of the original console of Xbox. So it was a great conversation overall. We went deep. I asked him questions that I always been curious for years. And we went behind the scenes of like, how was the process of working on that console, working with Sega, acquiring Rare, X-Boy. Oh man, it's a great conversation. I think you guys are going to love it. But first, head over to Gamertag Radio. Listen to our past episodes. And you could also find us on any podcast app. All you have to do, and just search for Gamertag Radio, subscribe, follow us, or even post a review, and it will help us climb the top of the charts because of your support. Now, if you would like to be part of our fan mail discussion or segment, here's how you could be part of the show.
Send us your feedback or questions. Give us a call at 786-273-7GTR. Email us at fanmail@gamertagradio.com or leave a message on speakpipe.com/gamertagradio.
All right, so we're going to go now straight to my conversation with Robbie Bach. And please, guys, all this week, I'm going to be out, you know, out of town, but I would love to see your feedback, your thoughts. Make sure to hit me up on Discord or go to Twitter. Hit me up at Godfrey, G-O-D-F-R-E-E, and I will read your feedback, your thoughts about this episode, all right? So we'll be right back after this. Enjoy.
You're listening to Gamertag Radio.
All right, so ladies and gentlemen, we have our special guest here, Robbie Bach. For those who don't know, he used to be part of the original team for Xbox back 20 years ago. I can't believe it's been 20 years, man. And Robbie has been on the show in the past. I believe it was on episode 500. He was on promoting his book, and he's back here. We're going to talk about the 20th year anniversary of Xbox and also his new book that's coming out later this year, man. So, Robbie, thank you so much, man. It's an honor to have you back on the show.
Hey, good to be here and happy to catch up with you. It's, gosh, that means it's been like 5 or 6 years. That's way too long in between talks.
Yeah, man. Time flies, right? Time flies. Insane. Crazy, crazy. But Robbie, man, how I know you're working on a book now. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And then we'll go from there, man.
Yeah, so since I left Xbox, I've been doing a lot of nonprofit board work and some public speaking and writing. I wrote my first book, which was a fiction or a nonfiction book, Xbox Revisited, and I loved doing that. That was sort of a business and civic strategy book, and talked a little bit about the Xbox story and things I learned from it. This latest book is actually fiction. It's called The Wilkes Insurrection, and it is a contemporary thriller. It's about what's going on in our country today, and it has all the elements of a thriller that you might expect. Nice. So I'm pretty excited about it. Got some cool new characters, and hopefully some nonstop action for folks.
Nice. How long have you been working on it?
Well, I started writing in the fall of 2016. And, you know, writing for me, if I'm writing a book, is a part-time activity because I have all these other things that I'm doing. So I would say there's probably two and a half years of work in a 5-year time frame. You know, it comes out on October 12th. You can pre-order it on Amazon already and on other book sites as well. And super excited about it.
Yeah. Are you planning to have an audiobook version or what?
We are. In fact, they are just starting recording the audiobook as we are talking here. I approved the narrator 2 days ago.
Oh, nice. You can't mention the name who it is, though, right? Not yet?
No,
okay. It's all good. It's all good. But Robbie, we definitely got to talk about this, man, because I can't believe it's been 20 years since the release of the original Xbox, man. Let's go from there, man, like memories, man, because before you guys were working on the console, you got to do some research about the business. And then during that time, I remember Sega Dreamcast was like a big thing in the late 90s, and then it flopped right away because of PlayStation 2. Like, what the type of research you guys were doing back then, too? Because this is like your first console ever for the team, for the company.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to think about the frame of mind we were in. You know, Sony was talking about the PlayStation 2 as a computer in the living room. So that sort of put us in the framework of, okay, well, this is a competitor, not just in the video game space, but a competitor to Microsoft's core business. And so the question, you know, we were asking, well, if anybody's going to put a computer in the living room, it ought to be Microsoft. And that's sort of where we got started. But once you dug in and you did the research and you talked to game developers and you talked to publishers and you talked to consumer electronics vendors and all those kinds of things, you sort of realized that, you know, it wasn't really about putting a PC in the living room. It was about putting a connected device in the living room. And what could that connected device look like? And what could that carry for the future? And I think that, you know, in the end of the day, the key innovation that Xbox brought to the marketplace was this idea of connected online, you know, social gaming. And that was a powerful innovation. And we got to the idea pretty early on. We didn't implement it until 2002 when Xbox Live came out. But that was, to me, a huge jumping off point in the industry.
Yeah, you know, I still have my original disc of the Xbox Live beta. I still got that, man.
Well, think about it this way. The idea that we had to distribute Xbox Live on disc, that tells you something about where the world was, because, you know, broadband, you know, this is 2001, 2002, broadband really didn't exist for most people.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, I recall being in a meeting with Bill Gates where he was upset at us for taking the 56K modem out of the Xbox.
Really? Why is that?
Well, remember, at the time, broadband was not an assumed success. Mm-hmm. And if you just had an Ethernet port, broadband was the only way you're going to be able to connect. Mm-hmm. And when you take out, you know, the alternative was a 56K modem. And, you know, so that was where the world was. And it's interesting at 20 years to think about how far we have come and the things we take for granted today. You know, the Xbox team today is talking about cloud gaming, where there isn't even any code running locally. I mean, think about how crazy that would have been to imagine in 2001. And likewise, in the online game space, the things that they're doing with Xbox Live today, I'd love to think we imagined them in 2001, but we didn't. We just wanted people to be able to play games together.
Yeah. Yeah, because one thing I do remember, and this is something that I remember the community would always talked about it on like in different forums, because that was a big thing back then. Message boards, besides before
yeah, exactly.
Social media. Yeah,
think about that. You were communicating with people on message boards. How crazy is that?
That is crazy. Yeah, no, but I remember during that time we were like, man, PlayStation, they have it handheld. Nintendo has it handheld. Why not Xbox? Let's release X Boy. You remember that?
I do remember X Boy. And look, the everybody used to say, well, X Boy would just be a, you know, a line extension for Xbox. Handheld gaming at that time was fundamentally different. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an extension of anything. It was a new platform. It would have required new games, a whole new development process, a whole new architecture. You know, and as it turned out, it was a good thing we didn't spend that money on XBoy, because along came the mobile phone and put a huge dent in those dedicated online gaming platforms.
Yeah. Do you guys were having a big debate on releasing a handheld back then? Because look now, man. Now we could easily just try xCloud now with Xbox, you know. So and what you think about that too? Like, have you even tried it? Just to see?
I have not tried it. Look, the hidden secret in all this is I'm not much of a gamer.
Yeah, we know that.
I'm horrible at gaming. The team wouldn't even let me demo the product, for crying out loud. So yeah. That's not my area of expertise. But at the time, we had multiple proposals from people on the team to do some, leave aside the name XBoy, but to do some mobile small device gaming system that was sort of a connection to Xbox. And there just wasn't the resource or the capability to bootstrap yet another business. And, you know, again, thankfully we didn't try to do that, because the mobile phone sort of usurped that marketplace by and large.
Yeah. You know, now in a couple of days, 9/11 is happening, right? The 20th mm-hmm. anniversary. I was in New York City when that happened. Now, I think I mentioned this to you too. That event that I went to, Xbox Unleashed, this was like a couple of weeks before the launch of Xbox. That helped me a lot during that time, because I still had those images of everything that happened during 9/11 in New York City. And I know you guys were stressed, because nobody knew what was going to happen after that. If you guys should still release the console, have an event in New York City, I believe of Times Square, Toys R Us, during that time wasn't even open yet. So you had to get permission from the city of New York to get access to the store. How stressful was that behind the scenes for you guys back then?
Well, just to complete your story, I flew into New York City the morning of 9/11.
Also, you were – oh, wow. Wow.
I landed at JFK that morning on a red eye from Seattle and drove to the Marriott Marquis in Midtown and went to sleep for 2 or 3 hours. And when I got up, the planes had already crashed and I didn't know about it. And I had a lawyer from our PR agency call me and say, "Hey, Robbie, I know your press tour has been canceled. If there's anything I can do, let me know." And I didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, "Well, you need to turn on the television." And so three of us from Microsoft and a friend from my church. We got in a Ford Taurus the next day and we drove all the way across the country.
Wow.
And look, for the team, that was super stressful. There was just tons of uncertainty. Team members were stranded in all kinds of places. We're trying to, you know, we've got a global supply chain. We're trying to build things. Thankfully, we were building a lot of our U.S. product in Mexico, so we could use trucks instead of planes. But, you know, then one of the trucks got hijacked. I mean, we had all kinds of challenges, and border crossing became more challenging. I mean, it put a lot of stress on the system. But, and, you know, for me, was a very meaningful, you know, not personally traumatic, but very meaningful event. I think of 9/11 as a jumping off point for a lot of different things. And, mm-hmm. you know, as we get ready to celebrate the 20th anniversary of that in a few days, that's absolutely on my mind.
Yeah. And when do you think that the whole team felt, okay, I think we're doing something right with once the console got released? Was it at launch? Was it a couple months after that, or years, or what?
No, that's a good question. I think for every team member, it was a little different. Remember that while the U.S. launch went pretty well, the European launch, which happened, 2 or 3 months later, was okay. Not fabulous, but okay. And the Japan launch, which happened in March of 2002, was pretty much a mess and didn't go well at all. And so, you know, depending on where you sat on Team Xbox, you know, if you worked for Bungie, you thought things were going great. If you worked for Microsoft Japan and the Xbox team in Japan, you thought things weren't going so well. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people, a big jumping off point was the launch of Xbox Live on November 15th of 2002. I think for some people, myself included, a big milestone for us was when Electronic Arts joined our platform. And we have this big event at E3 with Muhammad Ali on stage. And in addition to that just being cool, it was sort of a sign that we were serious and had arrived. But everybody experienced that on the team, I'd say, a little bit differently.
Yeah. When you guys decided to make a change of the controller, because I always been curious about that, because I remember going to the event Xbox Unleashed, and I tried out the controller for the first time. I'm like, man, this controller is pretty big. But I love the analog sticks to play Halo, right? But when you guys decided, hey, we should redesign the controller and make it smaller, because I've always been curious about that.
Well, so we actually didn't have to redesign the controller because the team had, before that, made the decision to create a smaller controller for Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
So what we essentially, the decision we had to make was, when do we convert everybody from the original US and European controller, which they called Duke,
yep,
to the S controller, which they call it, was what they called the controller in Japan. And that happened actually relatively early on.
Yeah.
I mean, despite all the user data we'd done where people liked the controller and it felt comfortable in their hands and they liked the fact that it was bigger, blah, blah, blah. Nothing made up for the fact that when people got it, they just said this thing's too big.
Mm.
And so we moved to the smaller controller relatively quickly. And I don't know how soon I've lost track of how soon we were able to fully turn over manufacturing that direction. But the decision happened early in the process.
Yeah.
And because we had the Japan controller already in development, there was an easy path forward for us.
That's awesome. I know you mentioned about Bill Gates was not happy about removing the 56K modem. Was there any other things that he was not cool with during the design of the original Xbox?
Not really. No. Look, Bill was incredibly supportive. I will say early on, so back in February of 2000, so this is very early in the development of the project, mm-hmm, we had a pretty epic meeting with Bill and with Steve Ballmer, which some of us have called it and now call the Valentine's Day Massacre, which actually happened on Valentine's Day. And it was a point at which, yeah, Bill and Steve Ballmer and the Xbox team came to grips with the fact that we weren't putting a PC in the living room. And in fact, what we were doing was building a video game console, because it became clear that Xbox, from an operating system architecture, was not a PC. Yes, it used DirectX. Yes, it had some networking protocols that were related to what Windows did. But it was not a multitasking operating system. It had no interruptibility. So once a game was running, the game controlled the box. It was actually quite different than a PC. And Bill was not happy about that. And we had a 3-hour argument about that that ruined everybody's Valentine's Day because it went till about 7:30 at night. But at the end of that, Bill and Steve said, okay, we'll trust you that this is the way we have to go. And he and Steve were remarkably supportive of the work we did from that point forward.
No, that's good. That's good. And I remember seeing him, Bill Gates, at the event at Toys R Us. So it was cool. And I remember coming out from the store, the whole Times Square was all green. I remember. I was like, oh, man, this is so cool, man. So cool. I've never seen this before.
You know, it was a weird time because Times Square was barely open.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there were police everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there was still this lingering, I wonder what's going to happen next, sort of perspective for people. Mm-hmm. So the fact that, you know, Toys R Us got open, that City of New York allowed us to do the event, I think in part because they wanted things to return to normal. But there was a lot of security, and Times Square was in a festive but sort of a different mode than you might have ordinarily seen on November 15th. It was a very unique time in history, that's for sure.
And when you guys decided to start working on the Xbox 360, and because that came out really fast compared to how it is now.
Well, so actually, I'll dispute what you just said in a moment, but let me go back to answer your original question.
Yes.
We started working on Xbox 360 very soon after the US launch. Because remember, the original Xbox was done with essentially off-the-shelf parts.
Mm-hmm.
Because we only had 18 months to do it, there was very little customization done. we knew to get to a good place from a business model perspective, we had to be able to do customization. We had to be able to design the product to be cost reduced. There was a lot of custom work that had to be done. Mm-hmm. And custom chipset work takes 3, 4, 5 years. And so we had to start right away. So the silicon team started very soon after the launch of Xbox, and started working on concepts and figuring out what we would want to do in the next set of silicon that would be Xbox 360. Now, Xbox 360 shipped quickly because, you know, we were losing so much money on the original Xbox. I mean, we lost money every time we sold a piece of hardware. There was just, you know, our cost was so much higher than what we were selling it for that there was no way to make money. Uh-huh. So we made that transition in 2005. That generation lasted a long time. So Xbox 360 was an 8-year generation. But since then, the cycles have actually been a little bit shorter. There have been more frequent updates. Now, they haven't been complete changes in generations, but there have been, you know, more frequent updates for different video outputs and mm-hmm. for different power components and different networking capabilities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I would say that the industry's cycle of change has actually sped up since the time of Xbox 360. And Xbox 360 was unusually long as a development cycle.
Yep.
You know, in market life cycle, mm-hmm. I should say.
Now, I just remember something. There was one thing that I was so disappointed about the original Xbox. And it was when I bought the console, I had to buy the DVD adapter, the control, yes. the remote, in order for me to watch movies. Because previously, I remember the PlayStation 2, you could just connect it and watch a movie like that. Why did that decision? That was so odd back then. So odd.
Well, so that's a business decision, right? Mm-hmm. Because to have the right to play back movies, you had to pay royalties. There were DVD royalties that were required. Well, Microsoft didn't make any money in the movie industry. So, and our box was already way too expensive for us to manufacture. Mm-hmm. The idea that we were going to build in $3 or $4 worth of royalty into the cost for every unit was just not, we just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And so we created the little dongle unit, which is a way for us. And it wasn't expensive. It was, I don't know, it was, $20
Yeah, $20-$30 something. Yeah.
$20 to watch a lifetime of movies. So amortized over the number of movies you watch, it wasn't a lot of money, but it covered our cost on royalties.
Okay.
And so we didn't have to pay the royalties. Ironically, a good chunk of the royalty money went to Sony.
Mm-hmm. Now, but during that time, I know I was watching the Tokyo Game Show, and I think it was Bill Gates that had he was speaking at a press conference, and he announced games that was going to come out on like the Sega Dreamcast, and Sega planned to release it for the consoles. I think with Jet Set Radio Future, GT, Sega GT. There was a couple other ones too. Shenmue also.
Yep.
I was very surprised. I was like, oh my God, is this going to be like a Dreamcast part two? So how was it? I know it's just a crazy question, but how was that getting a lot of those Japanese studios to work on games for Xbox? Because, you know, like you said, it was pretty difficult for you guys to get that type of partnership back then.
Yeah, it was actually quite difficult. I mean, the Japan game development market was tough for us. Most of the games there, it was a heavy focus on fantasy, a heavy focus on role-playing games, a heavy focus on adventure. Uh-huh. And, you know, those games sold really well in Japan. They sold somewhat well in the U.S. and Europe, but not as well. And in the U.S. and Europe, there was more of a sports focus, a little bit more of, as it turned out, ultimately with Halo, first-person shooting focus. And so you had different content for different marketplaces, and the Japanese publishers, you know, we struggled to sort of make a connection with them. You know, we had Dead or Alive. That was a great game for us. Itagaki-san did that game for us from Tecmo. But we really struggled, and Sega was also in transition. If you remember, they had just basically decided they were going to no longer be a hardware provider. And so they were looking for a software platform where they could differentiate themselves. And they also believed in online gaming. So there was a natural sort of connection there. You know, and as these things evolve, Peter Moore, who ran Sega of America, ended up coming to run marketing and ultimately to run Xbox for us at Microsoft.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I interviewed him a couple of years ago for the 20th anniversary of Sega Dreamcast. That was cool. That was really awesome.
Really, yeah, he's cool. He's a good guy and a good friend.
Yeah, yeah. What are the things that you've seen nowadays with the business that you probably like, man, you know what? This is really cool. Really, really cool that the gaming industry has been changing since, you know, 20 years ago. Was there anything that stood out to you recently?
Yeah, I think there's two things. Well, three things I'll say. Mm-hmm. First of all, the ability to abstract from the hardware is super powerful. So the idea that the hardware is becoming less and less important, I think is really great. I think it's a, you know, sort of a powerful evolution for what's going on in the gaming space. And so people are more and more focused on content and less focused on the hardware itself. I think the second thing that just kind of blows me away is the amount of community that's going on in the gaming space. The idea that you have something like Twitch, the idea that you have something like esports, where you have live performances in video games. I mean, think about that. If we had proposed that in 2001, people would have laughed us off the stage. And yet that's now where the industry is. And so there's a broadening of gaming as a form of entertainment that puts it absolutely neck and neck with movies and video and other forms of entertainment and even live sports. So that to me is powerful. And then I'm a business guy. So the business model evolution away from, selling DVDs at a certain price point to subscriptions and to these various types of subscriptions and to cloud access and those types of things. Mm-hmm. To me, that's super interesting and exciting. So you have migrations that are happening for gamers, which is really cool. You have migrations that are happening for fans, which is really cool. The fact that there are fans is really cool. And then you have migrations that are happening in the business. And all of that to me is pretty exciting.
Yeah. You know what? One thing that I'm very, very excited. I just love, first of all, I got to give major props to Phil Spencer and his team, because I just love the changes they've been making throughout the years with the company. And I just love also Xbox Game Pass. I truly love that service. And especially for those like low income family, they can now subscribe and instead of buying games every few months, they just pay monthly fee. And now they could, like you said, they could play on the console, they could play on the computer, they could play on their mobile device. That's a major, major game changer, man.
Yeah, and what's exciting about it for me is it's actually good for the industry because it's a sort of a more predictable revenue stream. Mm-hmm. But it's incredibly empowering for gamers and has actually broadened the market from being what we would have thought of as hardcore gamers into, as you say, families. And so you get this concept of a general form of entertainment that's easily accessible for a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds. It's just a way broader marketplace and obviously dramatically larger. Kudos to Phil and his team for recognizing that and making those transitions. Those are not easy transitions, but they've done a great job of it.
Yeah, yeah. So you stay in touch with a lot of people, the team over there still at Xbox? Or
there's a few people I stay in touch with. Phil happens to be a friend who I see in a couple of other contexts. So I stay in touch with Phil reasonably closely. Peter Moore has since left the gaming industry, but actually now he's back in the gaming industry. But I've stayed in touch with Peter pretty closely. And there's a few others still at Microsoft who I stay in touch with. But a few others in the gaming space generally. There's some folks at Activision who I know pretty well, and a couple people at Electronic Arts that I know pretty well. So I am not what I would say. I am not current in the gaming business, but I do sort of keep just one or two toes in the water to understand what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm going to ask you this question. I don't know if you're going to remember this at all, but where were you when there was the 1 million subscriber of Xbox Live?
Where was I when we had the millionth subscriber?
Yeah, because I seen a picture, I think, from someone from the team that described that moment when they found out that it was the 1 million subscriber for Xbox Live. Yeah.
I don't know where I was. That would have happened, though, probably in the first year of Xbox Live.
Really? So within a year. That's cool.
Xbox Live took off in a crazy way. And it went really fast. I'm going to guess it was in the first 12 months. And I know by the time we got to the end of Xbox itself, we were something like 4 or 5 million people, maybe even a little bit more than that. So, you know, my memory's a little hazy and I'm getting a little older, so maybe I'm misremembering. But my guess that happened in the first year.
Wow, first year. Was that – so it probably crazy. Blew up. It blew up right after the release of Halo 2 then.
It was partly Halo 2. Look, there was a bunch of products that actually drove it, some of which weren't even Microsoft products. You know, the Clancy series products were a huge part of that. And there were a number of others. And, you know, so those first couple of years, you know, Halo, the original Halo wasn't Xbox Live compatible. Everybody forgets that.
Yeah.
So it was some of the Clancy products, Halo 2 and a few others. And then ultimately when Electronic Arts came on board, the sports games that really got us going.
You know, my co-host, he went to E3 in 2001 and he was super curious about Xbox and he goes, oh, let me go to the booth. And he played Halo, the Halo demo that you guys had over there. He said it was pretty bad, the demo. So like how nervous were you guys when you had the demo available hands-on with that E3? Because that was your first E3, right?
It was not our first E3. It was the first E3 where we talked about Xbox. Or showed Xbox, let's say. Yeah. I've been going to E3 since 1997. Remember, we had a PC gaming business.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So we've been going to E3 for a while, and we talked about Xbox at the first E3. We did some private discussions. We're meeting with publishers and retailers, la, la, la. But this was the event where we showed things for the first time. And, you know, our press conference there was calling it a disaster would have been polite. It was really bad. And then Halo, unfortunately, we probably shouldn't have shown Halo. It wasn't ready. And we were showing a networked version of it. It was running on what was essentially beta PC hardware. It wasn't final Xbox hardware at all. It hadn't been video optimized. It was just a mistake to show it. And, you know, suddenly, you know, we're in May and we're launching the product in November. And you're thinking, well, gosh, how's that going to work? But, you know, the Bungie team knew exactly where they were. They knew exactly what was going to happen when they got real hardware. And they just told everybody to go away. Stop bugging us. We're not showing this product until it's ready. And then they tuned it, optimized it, and, you know, created something magical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that to me, that and Xbox Live were the reasons the original Xbox survived. They were the two critical pieces we needed to drive market share and to get ourselves a strong position in the gaming industry.
This is Gamertag Radio. Voicemail at 786-2737-GTR.
All right, Gamertag Radio listeners, let's talk about our sponsor, Oregon State University eCampus. As a GTR listener, you know what it's like to be part of an engaging online community. And at Oregon State University eCampus, creating that type of environment for students around the world is what they do best. Join a network of students as you pursue the degree online with Oregon State, a innovative provider of distance education. With more than 80 programs to choose from, and you can advance your career by earning an in-demand degree in fields like computer science, business, and digital communication arts. You could go right now. Right now, go under the description. I have the link right there. And just check it out. They have so many programs that I think this would be perfect for you. And I mentioned this many times on GTR that I wish I had something like this because I wanted to learn from the beginning about editing, creating digital content, especially with audio. And they have this over there at Oregon State University eCampus. But just like Calais, Pickford St. Pierre, whose environmental sciences bachelor's degree program traveled with her from Alaska to Australia, from Hawaii to Europe, and many more places in between. Oregon State eCampus is ranked number 4 in the nation for online education by U.S. News and World Report. And all online programs and classes are developed by the same world-class faculty who teach on campus at OSU. So, Gamertag Radio listeners, This is for you to call to action. Visit ecampus.oregonstate.edu/GTR to find the program that fits you best. That's ecampus.oregonstate.edu/GTR.
You're listening to Gamertag Radio.
You know, I still remember getting the Electronic Gaming Monthly issue where it said Xbox versus GameCube. I still have that issue, by the way. And seeing the reviews of Halo during that time was like all 10s. I was like, wow, that is crazy. Because remember, Nintendo is a very iconic company in gaming. Sure. So seeing those great reviews for Xbox during that time, that was really cool, man. That was really, really awesome.
Well, it was. And, you know, what was particularly, I suppose, satisfying or remarkable about it was that people didn't think a first-person shooter could make it in the console world. I mean, with the exception of maybe GoldenEye, mm-hmm. nothing had really been successful in the console world in that category. And so, you know, independent of what you thought of the GameCube hardware or the Xbox hardware or whatever, in the end of the day, people judge things based on the games. And when you had something that was new and differentiated, it made a huge difference. I mean, GameCube may be the only Nintendo platform ever shipped that I don't think had a really iconic game for it. And maybe I missed something, but it did okay, but it kind of struggled a little bit because there was never a game where you said, oh gosh, I got to have GameCube to absolutely positively play that unless it was, you know, the next set of Mario or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't something that sort of made it stand out. And we were fortunate in Xbox to have Halo to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think during that time, it was like, I think Star Wars came out for the GameCube and a couple other. Yeah, yeah. That was like the only launch. Yeah.
At that launch, at that E3, Star Wars was their big game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Star Wars did fine, but it wasn't defining, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody would dispute that. You know, I'm sure there's a bunch of Star Wars fans and a bunch of Star Wars gaming fans, so I don't want to make anybody mad. But Star Wars has always been a just fine franchise in video games. It has never been a knock it out of the park franchise for whatever reason.
We're almost going to be done here, but this is another one that I'm very curious. Were you involved when Microsoft acquired Rare during that time?
Yes.
Yes? And yes. How was that process behind the scenes? I'm so curious about this.
Well, you know, Rare was... again, kind of an iconic company. They were, they had done a lot of co-development work with Nintendo, places where Nintendo had licensed them characters and they had created games. Banjo-Kazooie, probably the best example of that. And so they were clearly experienced game developers and they knew what they were doing, but it was a very unique company. It's out in the middle of no place in central England. It was literally on a farm. They talked about their buildings as development barns, which I thought was strange. It was just a very unique place and sort of, I guess the right word is idiosyncratic. But they were really good at what they did. And, you know, so we were buying, A, some franchises that they were bringing to us, but also some really experienced core talent. Which ended up being super valuable when Microsoft got to Kinect and some of the franchises that they were able to develop in the Kinect environment.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, because I remember hearing the news that you guys acquired them at that time. I was like, what? Rare was known for making games for Nintendo, so that was shocking. That was very shocking back then.
Well, Rare was one of the strange elements of the Nintendo universe because it wasn't really owned by Nintendo.
Nah. That wasn't.
And Nintendo really liked to own its own studios, and they had their own game developers and their own assets. Mm-hmm. And Rare was sort of a contract studio for them, which was a little, you know, I think a difficult environment for the Nintendo people and probably a difficult environment for the Rare people.
Yeah, yeah. Now, but Robbie, man, anything else, man? Any great memories or cool stories that you want to say before we wrap it up about Xbox that still to this day you always think about? Anything special?
Well, the thing I would say, you know, I'd say two things. One, the fact that Xbox is 20 years old is a tribute to the fans. It's a tribute to gamers. Mm-hmm. That team really really loved the gaming community and loved to see people's eyes light up when they played a game. And whether that was on Xbox Live or just watching Halo or, you know, a Halo LAN party or whatever it was, Xbox 20 years is really a celebration for gamers. And I think the team, if, you know, we had all the original team here, they would say that, you know, whatever they created for that audience, and they got their benefit and their satisfaction from seeing that audience light itself up. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I would say, and this is going to sound goofy, but I think it's really true. The secret to Xbox was in fact the team. You know, there's a long debate about who the founders were of Xbox. And I think that's sort of a funny, weird conversation, because there wasn't a founder or even a small group of founders. There was a team. And that team changed and morphed over time. It started with some sets of people and shifted to other sets of people. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, getting Xbox and Xbox 360 done and Xbox Live done was a team exercise. And I was incredibly proud to be even vaguely associated with that team of people, because they were exceptionally good and exceptionally dedicated at what they did.
No, I feel like you guys completely changed the industry back then. Completely changed with online gaming, with Xbox Live Arcade. I remember getting the disc for that back then, before it was digital on the Xbox 360. There was a lot of things that you guys did that I've never seen in the gaming before. And now you see now more companies are actually now doing it differently and, you know, their own style. But it was cool being there as a fan of gaming, seeing the process was just amazing. And one other thing too, like I said in the beginning of the interview, how that event completely changed my life during the launch of Xbox. Because of you guys, I started creating content back 20 years ago, and I'm still doing it. And it was because of you guys. So I just want to say thanks, man, for... I know you probably didn't know about that, but...
Well, no,
I just want to say thanks, man. It's really cool.
I could say the same thing. When I'm writing this fiction novel, The Wilkes Insurrection, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about... where I learned the lessons of creativity, if you could say it that way. Where did I interact with creative minds the most in my life? And it was all on Xbox. And it was all the interactions I had with that team. Now, while there isn't an Xbox moment in the book, mm-hmm. the creativity in it, the ability to think about characters, the ability to create plot and describe scenes, that all came from my interaction and time with the Xbox team. And it's a powerful connection. And, you know, there's a virtual reality company in my book called Cybernoptics. And, you know, some of the things that are going on in that marketplace are reminiscent of what Xbox was doing, you know, 20 years ago. So I've drawn on that experience a lot. And I can imagine for you that it was inspirational. And it was certainly inspirational for me. And it's what inspired me to write this book, and I hope people enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's the name of the book one more time, and when is the release date so people could pre-order it now, man?
Yeah, it's called The Wilkes Insurrection, W-I-L-K-E-S Insurrection. There's a website, wilkesinsurrection.com. You can go check it out. There's a video trailer, there's playlists, there's all kinds of things, and you can pre-order it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the other book websites, and comes out on October 12th.
Yeah, make sure to check out the trailer. It's pretty cool. Really, really cool.
And thank you for taking the time to chat, Danny. Really good to catch up.
Nah, it's good. It's good, man. And good luck with everything, man. Good luck with the book too, man.
Yeah, stay in touch, and we'll talk soon.
All right, definitely, man. Take care, man.
Cheers.
Bye.
Send us your feedback or questions. Give us a call at 786-273-7GTR. Email us at fanmail@gamertagradio.com. Or leave a message on speakpipe.com/gamertagradio.
All right, that was a great conversation with Robbie. Thank you so much for being on. That was a lot of fun recording that episode. But yeah, guys, let me know your thoughts about the conversation. Man, the history. Oof, that was a lot of history in there, man. Super, super cool. All right, everyone. I just want to say thank you so much for listening to this episode. Stay tuned on Thursday. There's going to be another episode featuring Rihanna Emanuel and also Alyssa. We had from Save Point, we had a great conversation about Psychonauts 2, why this game is the most important game this year. So stay tuned, check it out. And until next time, thank you for listening. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.